Let's open our Bibles this evening to Revelation chapter 3, and we'll read through our passage again this evening. That we are, this is our third week here on the Church at Philadelphia. It's amazing for such short letters how much time you can spend, and I can tell you for sure, if we wanted to sit on all the little nuances that are involved in these things, we could be turning the leaves over and inspecting the things on the bottom of the leaves, because this is so fascinating here. But verse 7 then of Revelation 3, it says, "And to the angel or messenger of the assembly or the church in Philadelphia write, these things says the Holy One, the True One, the One having the key of David, the One opening and no one shuts, and shutting and no one opens. I know your works. Behold, I have given or set before you a door which has been opened, which no one is able to shut, it, because you have a little power, a little strength, and you have guarded my word, you have not denied my name. Behold, then I will give some out of the synagogue of Satan, the ones saying that they are Jews and are not, but they lie. Behold, I will make those, and they will come and worship before your feet, and they will know that I loved you, because you have guarded the word concerning my patience. I also will guard you out of the hour of temptation, which is about to come upon the whole inhabited world to tempt or to try the ones dwelling upon the earth. I am coming quickly. Hold that which you have, so that no one takes your crown. The one that is overcoming, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and I will absolutely never go out from him anymore. And I will write upon him the name of my God, the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, the one that comes down out of heaven from my God, and my new name. The one having an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." So, by way of quick review, all these letters are addressed first and foremost to the messenger of each church. And that's one of the reasons that we believe the word angelos, though it would be translated angel in some passages, it's one of the reasons that we believe that it is referring to a human messenger, in this case probably the bishop of the churches, because he seems to bear a relationship to the churches where his actions are responsible for things going on in the churches, which is not true of spirit being angels. So he addresses this, like all the rest of them, to the messenger of the church there. He also describes himself as the Holy and the True One. We went back and revisited that last week, that he is the one that is set apart, and it's because he is set apart that you and I are set apart in him, and that he is the genuine one, he's the true one, and that there is a relationship that you and I have to him as the truth. This isn't the truth, this is alethinos, not alethes, which is truth. This is true one. It has a different ending on it, so it's a true individual or a true thing, not truth itself. And he's the one that has the key of David, opens and no one shuts and shuts and no one opens. What has to do with, from what we can tell in the context, about allowing people into the kingdom, giving them access to the kingdom. And he has the ability to do that, ultimately. He really does. And then in verse 8, "And I know your works, that I've set before you an open door." Now notice he doesn't say an open door for David. He simply says, "I've set before you an open door." So he doesn't say that that open door is only with reference to the nation of Israel. Now, come back and revisit this a second. One of the things that I've been telling you as we go through this is each of these letters is addressed to a specific church, a real church that really existed in the 90s. 90s with two O's in front of it, you understand, of John's day. They were real churches. They're not make-believe churches. These are real churches. But each one of these churches represents characteristics that at any time throughout the history of the church, any church that you would find, any group that names themselves as a church or calls themselves an assembly with respect to God, they would always be characterized by one of these seven churches. predominantly. But one of the other things that I point out in here, because it was the way I was taught growing up, and I've got a little bit of reluctance toward this, but I've shared this with you before, and I can come back to this because it is of interest, and that is that these churches given in this particular order also, interestingly, seem to provide us a rough outline of church history. Now, I talked with another brother about this not long ago, and of course, he holds to that position more firmly than I do, and I tell him that my one reluctance to take that position wholeheartedly is it, in a sense, seems to undermine immanency. Although what he said to me is, well, all the churches existed in the 90s at the time John was writing this, and therefore it didn't have to be traced out in church history. And the other thing is to a certain degree, we're Monday morning quarterbacking on this, and we're looking back. But it is interesting how many of these churches do parallel the church that was dominant at that time in church history. The Philadelphian church is oftentimes described by people that take this position as the church of missionary love or church of missionary activity. And so they were the church where they really began to take the gospel around the world. Now, the first century church did that also. You had people that eventually began moving out in the first century and taking the gospel. But the church of the 1800s, which is oftentimes the church at Philadelphia, is the movement of the churches. Plymouth Brethren really saw themselves as a fulfillment of this particular brand of church. That group of church people, and then the other people that were influenced or that were related to all this, really began what we know as modern missions, really actively sending people around the world with the gospel, something that hadn't been done in that way. In fact, missions, to a certain degree, prior to this, was done. And you don't want to mischaracterize other church movements, but to some degree, missions prior to the 1800s was almost done simply by just influence and by the sword. In other words, people would move into an area and you'd have a lot of those people in an area and just their influence would be the missionary activity. So you'd have a bunch of people that would migrate to an area and they would have an influence that way. Or you actually exercised the power of civil government in such a way. The church recognized a distinction between the church and civil government, but they believed that the civil government was sort of, shall we say, the left hand of the church. To a certain degree, should answer to the church in enforcing things like this. And so the church prior had sometimes used the sword to enforce behavior, and by that, even attendance and membership in certain church situations. I don't know if some of you realize that, but in church history, in some parts of the church history, people went to church so that they didn't get into trouble. See? Well, you see that when you see that indeed this church does have set before them an open door. And so in one sense, you might say that this church could be described by a church that has a real active missionary program. But even if it isn't that, even if that is not the case, even if we don't take that position or grab that hook, line, and sinker, it certainly is that this church does have an open opportunity that he's given them. And he's given it to them, if you remember, because they don't have a lot of strength. And that lack of strength, remember the two possibilities? What were the two possibilities that could describe? What are the two positive possibilities that could describe how they lack strength?
Small in numbers.
And lack of resources. And in reality, oftentimes those two kind of go hand in hand, don't they? And so in reality, it could be either or it could be both. Okay. And the other thing is that they have actually guarded my word, which was another thing that was very important about this church. And we can't place too high of an estimate on this. In fact, actually following his statements about the church in Sardis, where you actually had a church that had a name, they had a reputation, but they didn't actually seem to be living that reputation out too much. And they actually had some pretty serious problems. This church, on the other hand, is one that has not denied. In other words, this church is holding very firmly to his word. And whether he's referring to this, or probably more likely to the word that he actually had spoke, which might be more the case, they did hold very firmly to that. And they also then did not deny his name. That is, they did not deny his character. They stood very firmly for who he is. And I was... I think it was last week I was teaching a Bible study. And I don't remember which one of the Bible studies I was in, but we were at, but we there was a question, and I ran to we went over eventually ended up in 2 Corinthians 4. And 2 Corinthians 4 is a very interesting passage, and let me show it to you here real quick, just so you're all looking at it. It's easier for you to see it than it is for me just try to tell you what's going on. But I think that this is again important when you're talking about his name. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, Paul says in verse 3, "But if indeed our gospel," if indeed, this is 2 Corinthians 4, 3, "if indeed our gospel is hidden, it is hidden to those who are perishing." In other words, the quandary is the people that need it the most are actually the ones that can't see it. Verse 4, And this is why, "in whom the God of this age has blinded," literally, it's not just blinded their minds, it's a word that has the idea of the product of their mind. In other words, when they cogitate, when you give them the gospel and they think through that, and their gears are turning, the output is wrong. That's the problem. He's blinded so that the output of their mind is not proper. I have given you the illustration before, that I have a relative that his mother attends a Catholic church. And if you ask her what the gospel is, she will tell you the gospel. And you'll go, wow, she gets it. But if you ask her why, if you died, would you go to heaven? And she would say, I hope so, or I think so. And if you asked why, it is not because of the gospel. And it's never because of the work. Excuse me, the work of Christ. Her answer is always, when he asks his mom, that it is because she's good, because she's been baptized, because she serves in the church, because she does good works, because she participates in the sacraments. In other words, her salvation is based on that. So even though she hears the gospel, when her mind and the gears turn out there, the outcome is, oh yeah, he did that, but I'm saved by this. It's not that I'm saved by what he did. See? So he says the results are the products of the minds of the unbelieving, so that the illumination or the light of the good news should not shine. In other words, Satan keeps them so that they don't ever get this, of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. Now, the end of verse 4 is important. The glory of Christ, who is the image of God. Now, when we're talking about the glory of Christ, we're talking about who he really is. We're talking about his character. We're talking about, as we were talking about on Sunday, his reputation. We're talking about the proper, accurate opinion of who Christ is. Ben. Glorious gospel. They're attaching glory here to the word gospel, which is okay, but I wouldn't translate it glorious gospel. I would say it's the gospel that consists of the glory about Christ. Okay? I don't think he's saying, what they're doing is you have people that are trying to translate this, and a lot of them I don't think fully understood the word glory. Okay, we talked about glory this last Sunday morning. Sasha asked me a question. How did we end up with the word glory in our Bibles? I didn't know. It's the way that it is. So I actually went back and I pulled up, looked at this up in the dictionary. And you know, in 1611, you know what the word glory meant? Number one idea of the word glory in 1611, or in ancient, in Old English, the original meaning, well, glory came from an Old or Middle English, which came from Old French, which comes from Latin. And all of those words meant, first and foremost, name or reputation. That's what they meant. Name or reputation. That's what they meant. And then, glory also meant, because if you stop, this goes along oftentimes with a person's reputation, it often referred to a boast. Which is why, in your old King James Bible, they have the Greek word kakaomai, which does mean boast, and I translate it boast, but they translate it glory. I will not glory except in this. And we don't get that, because we don't use glory like that. See, the word has, that meaning has largely dropped off in popular usage. So when we're talking about glory here, and a person translates this glorious gospel, that doesn't communicate a whole lot. Because that's like saying, I go out, and it says, Dan was using this word the other day. Oh, that's just glorious. And what we might mean by that, it's because this was one of the other meanings of glory. It meant splendor. And isn't that oftentimes what we mean? We say it's a glorious day. We say it's a splendorous day. There's oh, this day's splendid. This, oh, you know, we're going to be saying that in a short while. We're going to have forgotten how hard January was in a short time. Your crocuses are going to start pushing up, and your tulips, and the trees will eventually here into March. They'll start budding out and everything, and we'll all go, oh, it's just glorious. The air is a little bit warm today, and it's, oh, you love that. But that is not what he means here when they translate it glorious in your Bible. What he's talking about is it's a gospel about, shall we say, the opinion concerning Christ. Or to put it another way then, the gospel or good news about the reputation of Christ, who he is. What reputation does God give Christ? What opinion does God the Father have of Christ? And I was sitting, I've been spending some time thinking about this. When you go on, in fact, if you go on down to verse 4, we're going to skip verse 5 just because it, because he says we don't preach ourselves but Christ. In verse 6, because God is the one having spoken, out of darkness let light shine. Now, when did God speak that? In Genesis 1? That's not what he's talking about here. He's not referring to Genesis 1 in here. It's always interesting when you read, most modern people think that that these New Testament writers, when they're writing, they're constantly, they know their Old Testament, so they're always trying to pull all Old Testament verses out and quote them and throw them into their writing and stuff like that to give. Listen, when they quoted the Old Testament, they quoted the Old Testament, and I don't think they spent all time to write allusions to Old Testament things just because they were thinking that way. And I don't think he's talking about Genesis 1 here. He's talking about the fact that God the Father actually said, light shine out of darkness. And he says, when he did that, he's the one who shone in our hearts for a giving of light or an illumination, a result of a lighting up of the knowledge. So that light results in you having knowledge. That knowledge is about, now we come back to glory again, the same word that we'd add back up in verse 4. The glory of God. Now we're talking about God's opinion. In this context, of the person of Jesus Christ. In other words, what does God the Father say about Jesus Christ? What reputation does he give? You know what? Have you ever known anybody that is a person of, shall we say, name or renown or reputation? Oh, renown. There's the other. That was one of the other popular ideas of the word glory in its old use. Renown, which is fame. Fame. There was one of the other words they had for their old definitions in there. Fame or renown. Well, you know, have you ever known people that are famous? Was Jesse James famous? Was he famous in a good way? No. Are there people that are famous that don't deserve to be famous? I would say so. Are there people that are famous because they're famous within a certain group of people? Sure. When he's talking here about the glory of God in the person of Jesus Christ, what he's saying is, in very simple terms, the difference between a believer and an unbeliever is that let's take an unbeliever in a church that holds to most orthodox doctrines. But you know what the difference between that believer and that unbeliever in that situation is? The believer gets who Christ is, and the unbeliever doesn't. The believer knows who Jesus Christ really is. He gets him. In other words, if you put this together here, what Paul says here in 2 Corinthians 4, an unsaved person always has some flaw in his understanding of who the person of Jesus Christ is. There is some flaw in there so that he never believes in him. Why would you believe in somebody that you don't really believe was raised from the dead? Why would you trust him your salvation? So if you're a JW and you don't believe he's raised from the dead, you know what you're going to do? You're going to work for your salvation. You're not going to base it on the death of Christ because he's not really God. There's a flaw. And second of all, he's not raised from the dead. If you're a Mormon, are you going to work for your salvation? Yes, because that person isn't absolutely God. He is a God, but he's the progeny of another God who was a progeny of another and back and back and so on and so forth. And he's basically what you will be someday if you're a Mormon. And so you have a faulty view of who he is that way. So you don't really believe that one really paid for your sins. So faulty view. So you're not really going to believe in him for your salvation. You're going to work for your salvation. And we could go through that and we could take all kinds of groups, all kinds of churches, and even people that attend our church, if they're not saved, ultimately... And this, so I'm talking about people that give assent to a lot of Christian things, but really aren't saved. The problem is always with regard to who the person of Jesus Christ is. They've got something flawed in their understanding of Christ. And you could sit and you could give them the best catechism on Christ available, and it's not going to fix it. Because according to this passage, God the Father has to shine the light in there so the light comes on and they get it. They see who he is. And you know what's so incredible about that is that God can do that and he can take a person that's 90 years old that is resisted and he can turn the light on and then they can go, I see it. And he can take a 4-year-old kid in his bedroom with his mom, that's me, and he could turn the light on, so I got who Jesus Christ was. Now, if you would have given me a doctrinal test on the person of Jesus Christ, there's probably some things I wouldn't have grasped. But if you would have asked me, is he God? I wouldn't have had a problem with that. Did he die for your sins? I wouldn't have had a problem with that. Did he rise again from the dead? I wouldn't have a problem with that. See? But there's other people who would. So anyway... So I'm saying this, we come back and revisit some of these things because I think it's important for us to grasp when we're looking at this church here in Revelation 3, when he says that you have not denied my name, for us to grasp what it means, for this church to stand there and hold to the character of who this person Jesus Christ is. There are people all around the world. Let's put it this way, Christendom is still a large movement in the world. Christendom at large is still a large movement, but the bulk of Christendom is unsaved. Most people that call themselves Christians in the world or attend in some way or are connected in some way with what would be called a Christian church, whether it's Baptist, Methodist, Evangelical Free, Catholic, Presbyterian, Lutheran, I don't know, and probably a lot of other names that I've never heard of. But the bulk of those people are not saved because they've got a flaw in their understanding of who Jesus Christ is. Even in churches who their doctrine might be orthodox, the people don't really get it, and so the people themselves don't really hold to it. It's not a big deal for some of them to even give it up. Because, hey, in fact, I was actually listening to Albert Mohler, who is the president of Southern Baptist Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. And he was speaking at a conference at another thing, but he was talking about the modern atheists. And I was talking to Peg about this yesterday. It was so interesting listening to the things he was going over. But one of the things that he said is most of modernism, the liberals and such like that, it's not an easy thing for them to give up these things because when they interview people about God, they ask these people in these churches, do you believe in God? Oh, yeah. Okay, do you believe in a personal God? Do you believe in a God that cares about you, that actually knows everything, is really in control of the world, really could provide, could save you and everything like that. And he had, there was one man that in the set of interviews that they were doing that probably summarized it as well as anything he said. And that is, he goes, oh no, I just believe in a plain old ordinary God. That's the way he does it. I just believe in a plain old ordinary God. What does that mean, a plain old ordinary God? In other words, which in reality, you know what? That'd be the case. It would be a plain old ordinary God. If he's not a God that's in control, and he's not a God that cares about you, and he's not a God that can actually save you, then he would be a plain old ordinary God.
He's putting the definition of like the Greek gods.
Sure. Almost. It's almost what it comes down to, isn't it? Then last week we were in verse 9. We looked at the fact that he said, I'm going to give some from the synagogue of Satan. And my wife had quite a question on this, and so I wanted to make sure we understood this. When he says this in the Greek text, because it's not represented in your English Bible, but in the Greek text there is a preposition, it's an ek preposition, and it's used with the genitive case, and it's a idiom in Greek that when you have ek with the genitive case and you're talking about a group of people, it normally refers, well, not normally, but it refers to some from. It doesn't necessarily mean the totality of. Okay? So, in verse 9, he's going to have some from, is, and that's the way my interlinear translates it, and I think that's the way I think that's even the way the net, if you have a Alfred Marshall interlinear, that's the way they translate, he translates it in there, is some from the synagogue of Satan. And what we pointed out was not everybody that is in the synagogue of Satan, in other words, not everybody in Christendom that believes that you are under Mosaic law, not all of them are unbelievers. The bulk of them might be, but there are believers, real believers, that are in assemblies, that believe that you ought to live by Mosaic law, that believe that it's a good thing. They don't believe that they're saved by it, but they believe that it's a good way of life. And in fact, in reality, I was raised that way. I was raised being taught that we ought to keep the Ten Commandments. And in fact, I would have to say most of probably, to some degree, evangelicalism in America even. And we're talking about believers now. That's why I say evangelicalism. Most of those people probably have that idea in there. Even if they're people that say, well, we're not under law. And I've heard this a lot. Well, we're not under law, but we still live by the principles of the law. See? And what was, and I remember way years ago, back before Peg and I were married, and I was teaching a Bible study on that on that particular topic, and I made that comment, and we had a friend, Tim, who was in our wedding, and Tim was in the Bible study, and Tim goes, a rose by any other name would still be just as, and I think, what is it, it's from Shakespeare, would still be just as sweet. So he goes, law by any other name is still law, it's still, it's just as burdensome, it's still wrong. So some from that assembly then were going to come, and they were going to bow. They were going to bow because he was going to bring them out and he was going to judge them. They would be being judged either at the end of the tribulation or at the great white throne at the end of the kingdom, because there will be judgments in both situations. And then in verse 10, he says, because you have kept the word concerning my patience. And again, that was important, because what we find from that is that at the time that this was being written, there were people, apparently in Philadelphia, in this area where this church was at, there were people that were trying to teach that Jesus Christ did not take his cross patiently. He was impatient. He swore, spit, hurled insults at the people that were around him, which was normal for people to do. But see, Jesus Christ was anything but normal when it came to this. And so when Jesus hung on the cross, he didn't do that. And this church guarded that word of his patience. This church guarded the fact that when Christ hung on the cross, he didn't act like that. And when Jesus Christ hung on the cross, he was silent. He didn't insult. He didn't spit. He didn't cuss. Okay. And because of that, he promised them that they would not go into that time of trial. Well, that brings us to verse 11. All of that is a lot of review, but we pulled a couple of other things out in verse 11. Then he says, "Behold, I am coming quickly," or "I am coming quickly." Now, that's a statement of imminence. Imminence, if you remember, is maybe one of those big words. All we mean by that is Christ could come at any moment. That's what imminence is. We really do believe, according to Scripture, that Jesus Christ could come for us at any moment. He could actually come before I finish this Bible study tonight. And if you ever stop to think about it, when you're in the middle of a sentence, and this has hit me oftentimes when I'm kind of really thinking about the rapture, that it actually is running through my mind, he could come back before I finish this sentence. Good. Now, obviously, he didn't come back before that one, but he could have. He could have. And the thing is the New Testament writers lived with that anticipation. They really did. Paul, remember, when he writes 1 Thessalonians 4, states it twice there in 1 Thessalonians 4. He expected to be among those who were still alive when Christ came back. He did not expect to be among those who needed to be resurrected. He didn't expect to die. Now, that didn't mean Paul didn't think he was ever going to die, that he thought he was going to be immortal. It was the fact that he thought Christ was going to come back before he would die. That's what Paul thought. And so we have this again right here in verse 11. "Behold, I'm coming quickly." Now remember, that's from God's perspective. In which, what does it say? In 2 Peter 3, "A day with the Lord is as a thousand years." As David says over in the Psalms, a thousand years is a watch in the night. So in other words, one way or another, it's not very long. So he says, "I am coming quickly. And that which you have, hold fast to." He has the word kreteo here, which means to have a firm grip on, to hold something with a firm grip. "That which you have, so that no one takes your crown." Now your crown is not your salvation. There are five crowns, victor's wreaths, and these crowns are Stephanos. When you get over to Revelation 12, when we get over there, you're going to see Satan appearing as a dragon. And he has diadems upon his head. You're going to see a beast in Revelation 13 with diadems. Now, those are what I thought of crowns as a kid. And I never had anybody explain this to me when I was growing up in church, or if they did, it went in one ear and out the other. And I usually did pay pretty good attention to stuff like that. But I always thought we were going to get these fancy gold crowns. You know, like the kids get at Burger King, you know, those things like that. Except real gold with real jewels on it. And I was always thinking, that's going to be really cool. You know, a real diadem. But you and I aren't going to get diadems. You and I are going to get Stephanoi. We get the word Stephen from this. Now, a Stephanoi was a wreath. Oftentimes a laurel wreath, sometimes a wreath of olive branches. And a Stephanoi was a victor's wreath. It's what they were given. It's what the competitors in the what we know as what we would call Olympic Games today, they had, through in their times, they had the Panathenean, I still can't say it, games that were games in honor of all of that area around Athens, in honor of Athena, celebration of their games. If you could have seen the frieze of their, I did a paper for college on the frieze that goes around there, and it's a celebration. It's the people celebrating those games, and it had to do in part with the victories of the Peloponnesian Wars over there and the things that had taken place as a result of that. Those were the wreaths that those people won. When you threw javelins and you ran races and you won, when you got done, you didn't stand up front and they give you a gold medal around there and a silver and a bronze for second and third places. You got victor's wreaths. But our victor's wreaths are going to be gold. I want you to turn to chapter 4 here in Revelation. We haven't been over here officially yet. But in Revelation chapter 4, there's going to be a group of individuals here. And Revelation chapter 4 in verse 6, and before the throne there was a sea like glass, like crystalline, in the midst of the throne, and around the throne there were four living beings full of eyes in front and in the back. I went down too far. I jumped down ahead of it. Verse 4, and around the throne, there it is. Sorry, pardon me for that. And around the throne there were 24 thrones. Now, some of your Bibles have 24 seats, because apparently they didn't want anybody else on thrones up there but God. But literally in the Greek, there were 24 thrones around the main throne. And see, that God is not threatened by that, so they can translate seat all they want. It's still a throne as far as God's concerned. And throne indicates that there's some sort of a ruling capacity, right? That's why they're on a throne. And upon the thrones there were 24 elders sitting, having been clothed in white garments, and upon their heads, notice this now, gold crowns, or literally gold stephanoi, gold victor's wreaths. So their victor's wreaths that these elders have, and we've just referred to this before, but we kind of come back to it now. We do believe that these elders are representative of the church in heaven, carrying out priestly activity and preparing for some sort of a ruling capacity, which is why they're on thrones. And we'll deal with that in more detail when we get to Revelation 4. But they're wearing victor's wreaths that are made of gold. So if they're representative of the church, what kind of victor's wreaths will we get? Gold victor's wreaths, not ones made out of laurel wreaths, or olive branches. They won't be made out of that. They'll be made out of this. Now, there are five that you and I, as a believer, have the potential to win. There is one that Paul refers to over in... I'm just going to give them to you too quickly. We're not here to go through and teach all of these tonight. But there's one that I do want you to see, first of all, in 1 Corinthians 9. Because I think that this one could be related to what we're looking at here. Now, in the overall context of chapters 8 and chapters 9 of 1 Corinthians, and even into chapter 10, Paul's dealing with the issue of Christians doing things that bother some Christians, but in reality are okay, but they just may not be best for everybody. And so Paul's basically saying, listen, you know, I'm going to give you my example. My example is I always put other people first. Whether they're saved or unsaved, I try to put their needs first and not let anything I do get in the way. And that's really hard for us to do, because we put our needs first. So we could say, but my stomach's hungry. My stomach's hungry. And I can get a 99-cent Whopper offered up there at the Temple of Diana, and I can get that for 99 cents. But if I get one that's not offered at the Temple Diana, I got to go down the street and I'm going to pay $1.50 for it. I'm going to go for the 99 cent one, the Diana burger. Say, now, I'm not trying to make light of it. I'm just trying to give you an illustration in modern terms of their scenario. And Paul says, listen, I'm going to bring my body into control. So he says in verse 24, do you not know those then that are running in a race, all of them run, right? If you're running a race, is there anybody that doesn't run that's in the race? No, they all are running. But one receives the prize. So Paul says, so run like you're going to obtain it. You're not out there. In other words, what he's simply saying is, when it comes to your Christian life, treat it like you're running in a race. Don't treat it like you're out there for a Sunday stroll. Verse 25. And everyone in agonizing or competing, he exercises self-control with all things. Those do it, however, to receive a perishable wreath. If you got those wreaths, you could maybe hang it on the wall or set it on a shelf and it would last for a while. But what happens when you bring foliage in that's been cut off from its life source? It dries up, gets brittle, somebody bumps it, the leaves crumble, falls on the floor, the thing becomes a mess. It's perishable, it rots, it decays. But we do it that we might receive an imperishable. So Paul's saying there's an imperishable Stephanos that we can win. And he uses perishable Stephanos and then imperishable. He only uses Stephanos once here. Verse 26. Therefore I run not with uncertainty. And Paul says, And I box, not like I'm beating the air. In other words, I'm not shadow boxing. Rather, I treat my body with severity and I make it my slave so that having preached to others, I do not become disqualified or, in this context, I don't win. I don't want to have told everybody else, go out there and win the race. And then I myself, you know, tuckered out coming around the last curve and I just laid down on the track and never crossed the finish line. See, and you'd look at that guy and you'd say, you know, to me that's one of the always things they always appreciate about, I like track and you watch cross country, because I like those sports because everybody should finish. All you have to do is finish. And I'm one of those guys that I like to see the last guy come across the finish line even. I just like to see him try. It's the people you get frustrated. It's the person that goes out to run the race and they get out there halfway through it and they decide, I'm not going to win this thing. I'm just going to walk. You go, what? Try. Do it. And that's what Paul's getting at. But he says there's a crown for that. There's a crown for you bringing your body under control and not just going, I can't win it. I'm just going to give up. $5.99 Whoppers. Five of them. I'll take five. You just throw it in. You don't try. So there's a crown, shall we say, for you keeping at it and not letting your needs and physical needs and physical nature and everything get in the way to just make you just toss it in and quit. Okay? That's what Paul's getting at. Now, there's one other one I want you to see. Paul has one for winning people to Christ that he refers to, I believe, in both in Thessalonians and in Philippians. There's one for the exercise of your spiritual gift that he refers to in that Peter refers to in 1 Peter 5, and he talks about there an elder, a crown for a bishop. And I know not everybody agrees on this, but I think that that's not just that there's a crown just for the bishop. He's happened to be referring to bishops. But I think that that crown would be true for anybody who faithfully exercises their gift in the capacity God wants them to. But maybe it is just a unique gift for the bishop. You know, I know some guys that would like that, but maybe that's not the case. But the other one I want you to see is in James chapter 1. And this one may... This might be the other one, and then we'll talk about these two in this in the context of Revelation 3. Now, in James, again, you have believers that are going through a temptation. They're going through temptation because they're outcasts. They've lost their property, they've lost a lot of things, and as outcasts and having lost all this, they're trying to figure out how to get it back. How do I reclaim possessions that have been lost? Or, shall we say, acquire new ones to take their place? How do I regain status? And so they're being tempted. And so he says in verse 12, happy then is the man who endures or takes patiently temptation, because coming to be approved, he receives a crown of life, which was promised to those who are loving him. In other words, God, we would say, promise this to those who are loving him. In other words, one of the ways that you can love your God, love your Lord, is by actually enduring temptation. This is one of the motivations for living the Christian life. Remember, we were talking about on Sunday about having motivation right for living the Christian life. And oftentimes when you start living the Christian life, early on, you try to live it to stay out of trouble. In other words, think about it. There's probably a difference between his attitude towards obedience and his older sisters. In other words, she probably is at the age now where she can appreciate all the work and effort that her parents have put in, and she wants them to be pleased by the way she makes choices. But oftentimes at his age, they obey more because they don't want to get in trouble, because they got in trouble for that yesterday, and maybe today I don't want to deal with that. So today I'm going to try to not do that thing again. See? And so that's actually kind of the way the Christian life is. But as you grow as a Christian, you do come to the place where you learn to love God in such a way that you say, you know what, I can have a motivation for resisting this temptation, that I'm showing love for God who has loved me. But he calls it a crown of life, and I believe it's a crown of life because if you have victory, what can you manifest then? What can you show forth in your life? you can show forth life. See? If you're not having victory, you can't be showing forth life at that moment in time. If you are sinning, if you're living out the sin nature or giving into a temptation for Satan or from the world system, you can't be living out God's life at the same time. You have it, but you can't live it out. Now, so this is a crown that's related to you living out that life, having victory. Now, this crown and the one mentioned in 1 Corinthians 9 have some similarities, but I think that there's also some distinction. This one really is about dealing with temptation, whereas the one in 1 Corinthians 9, I don't know so much that it's a matter of temptation specifically as it is simply not letting your needs and your appetites get in the way of doing what God has for you to do. You can see that there's a close relationship, but I don't know that they're identical. Now, if we go over to Revelation 3, of the two, while my first inclination was to say, well, this is probably the crown he's referring to in James 1, the crown of temptation, which if you stop and think about this now, we're in Revelation 3, Revelation chapter 3, and remember in verse 10 it says, because you've kept the word concerning my patience, I also will keep you out of the hour of temptation that's about to come on the whole inhabited earth to tempt them or to bring out something bad. And then he says, I'm coming quickly. That which you have, you hold it firmly so that no one takes your crown. Now, in the context here, I could see that following on the heels of verse 10 where he's talking about temptation on the world, when he's talking about what they're going through, that you could see that he would be in verse 11, perhaps referring to a crown for resisting temptation. Can everybody see that? Can you see that? So it could be that crown. Could be the crown that James is referring to. But there's also the possibility that this could be referring to the crown in 1 Corinthians 9. Because that crown over there, let's put it this way. When you are small, when you have not a lot of resources, it's real easy sometimes to do what? Just kind of throw in the towel. To just kind of give up. To just say, oh, let's just keep getting together for church, but you know, we don't need to put up with this stuff anymore. We just take it easy. And so I can easily see how the crown in 1 Corinthians 9 could also be in here. So in possibility, we could have two different crowns that he's referring to. He mentions one, but he could be mentioning that one crown here in this context. He uses it with a definite article, but he could be using it, shall we say, in a general sense of referring to a crown. The makes me think that he probably has a specific crown in mind. And of the two, while, like I said, my first inclination is to go with the one in James, I'm more strongly influenced to think that he may be talking about the crown in 1 Corinthians 9. In other words, because this church does seem to lack strength, and they have some really good things going for them, but there is the one temptation that maybe, you know, we've been put upon that church, that synagogue of Satan kind of gives us a rough time. You know, he doesn't. Obviously, the very fact that he mentions the synagogue of Satan is indicating that they've created a little conflict with this church. And you know what? I understand that. Because, I'll share this. We have finished trying to deal with stuff, putting together a book on living by grace. Just some basic things on living by grace. I have not written that book to try to harp and be mean to anybody, any Christian that wants to live by law. I don't want to call them names. I don't want to call them stupid. I don't want to do those things like that. I've been inclined to be rude to them in the past. That's not my desire. But it is, and I'm not saying I haven't done that, and I'm not saying that people that talk about living by grace don't do that sometimes. But my experience is it is more common for Christians that live under law to really harp and ride the Christians that live under grace. In other words, to them, it just drives them nuts that there are people that there are Christians out there that will not give assent to living by the same standard that they think that everybody should live by. You understand what I'm saying? In other words, it just drives them nuts. In me, all I can say is I really feel sorry for Christians that are living under law, because it is so wonderful to know what liberty is and to know what real freedom is. And they don't know that. They'll say that. I've heard them say, we know liberty and freedom under law because law is freeing. But they're denying scripture when they say that. And I don't think that they don't really know what it is. And I don't know that I even fully understand all of what it means to be liberated and free. I get tastes of it, but I myself haven't fully tasted it yet. And I'm saying that because I think this synagogue of Satan, the very fact that Paul mentions the synagogue of Satan in the context here, means that some of those people have been giving those believers that understand something about real liberty, real freedom, probably been giving them a hard time. Does everybody understand that? And therefore, I believe when he says, behold, I am coming quickly, and that which you have, hold it firmly so that no one takes your crown. I believe that that could be that crown that comes from these people living at liberty. And one of the things that Paul ultimately says with liberty, interestingly enough, in 1 Corinthians 9, and he brings it out in Romans 6 too, is liberty is not ultimately about the fact that you get to eat steak, whether it's offered to an idol or not. Ultimately, it's about the fact that you get to be freed from the sin nature so you can serve other believers and the steak becomes a non-issue. You don't even care about the steak anymore. You're more concerned about that believer.
Amen.
See? And that's what Paul ultimately gets to. Thank you. Thank you. See. And that would be that crown. So do you understand in the context why I lean a little bit more strongly, having considered this, on the crown in 1 Corinthians 9? Okay. Because there could be a real temptation for these people to say, man, these guys won't get off our backs. And then the other thing that would go along with that crown is, would you really be living at liberty if you went after those people like a dog with a bone? If you really started letting into them, would that be real liberty? No. More likely than not, according to Paul, you'd actually be becoming carnal. You'd be venting your flesh. You'd be giving your flesh an avenue for you to get hot and ticked off and angry. In a bad way. Okay? And remember, Paul, while he tells us with an imperative verb to be angry over at Ephesians 4, Paul says, but don't sin. Because Paul knows, yeah, there are things worth getting angry about, but it's real easy to sin when you do that. And you got to really watch yourself. So it's almost better not to be angry at times than it is to take the chance of, but I don't want to contradict Paul.
So you think this is actually... You say you sway more towards James.
My initial inclination is towards James. But in considering the full context here, I think that the 1 Corinthians 9 perhaps fits this better.
Because of the liberty issue.
Yeah. Okay. And I usually have taken this commonly to be the James. I've always thought, well, you know, there's temptation and such. And you know, it could be both. But because he does use the definite article, it kind of makes me think that maybe he's referring to the 1 Corinthians 9. It's that one where you're going to bring yourself under control so that you can run the race without hindrance, and also, I would say, without being a hindrance to others, too.
Yeah.
Any other questions at this point? Wow, 53 minutes already. What in the world happened here? I have to finish this tonight because I can't bear to face Ben and tell him that we really did finish. You guys don't remember his comment Sunday morning. when Ben said...
Ben Orth
says, Tim's going to be finishing... the church in Philadelphia in Revelation 3 or maybe not finishing... I'm joking. He wouldn't care one way or another. I'm just joking about that. Anyway, any questions? Because we'll save verses 12 and 13 for next week.
Through our notes here. I haven't been watching my paper tonight.
Well, we can try. Let's see. We're on page 16. And let's see, down to verse 11 is where we picked up tonight.
Okay, could we start in 10? Who are those who are, dwell upon the earth?
Oh, that's from last week, yeah. Okay, and who were those people that dwell on the earth? Does anybody remember? Who are those that dwell on the earth?
Earth dwellers, unbelievers.
They're earth dwellers, so they're unbelievers, that's right. Yeah, this earth is their home. Okay. I know that's not a popular song in Christianity at large anymore, but it's still a good song. This world is not my home. I'm just passing through. We're not earth dwellers. We are, as Paul says in Philippians 3, we are citizens of heavens. We're not citizens of the earth ever. Paul never sees us that way. Peter does not see us that way. He sees us as pilgrims and sojourners. Okay. Then verse 11, what do they have and what is their crown? So what do they have? Well, maybe we didn't explain that. Maybe we ought to take a couple seconds what do they have? He says, that which you have, hold fast. I think they have a testimony. They've got a testimony that they've stood for who Christ is in terms of his character, his name, remember?
Yeah, doesn't that go back to the things that he...
Where he's talking about the holy and the true.
Yeah.
And those are some things that are true about him. They also have an open door. They have an opportunity to serve. And again, think about that. In the context of 1 Corinthians 9 and that crown, Paul's talking about you have opportunities out there. And sometimes, essentially, you can throw those opportunities away by not controlling yourself. And that's what Paul didn't, that was one of the things Paul didn't want to happen. So lose an opportunity. Paul said, to the Jews, I become like a Jew. To the Gentiles, essentially, became as a Gentile. Those who are under law, Paul acted, in other words, we might say in modern terms, to those that lived under law and kept kosher, Paul didn't go in front of them and sit down and eat a ham and cheese sandwich. He didn't pop a plate full of oysters. Paul would eat kosher around them so as not to offend them. But when he was around people that were lawless, Paul went off and caused all kinds of trouble. No, Paul just didn't act like an intense nitpicker about law. So in other words, if he's sitting down with those guys, Paul might eat a ham sandwich. If they set ham out, Paul's not going to sit there and go, oh, can't eat that. No, because he doesn't want them to go, oh, why can't you eat ham, Paul? He doesn't want that to get in the way. So he'll eat ham with them, you know, because there wasn't anything wrong with it. So he'd go both ways. In that situation where those things that could go up and down like that. And I don't know if you ever thought about that, but Paul here, this great Pharisee, may, as a believer, when he was with Gentiles and knew there weren't Jews around, might actually have eaten ham, for all you know. Might have.
So the things they have are the things that are holy and true and the opportunity.
Well, Christ is the one that's holy and true, but I think it's more the fact that it's... We might say it's the Christian life and the victory they have because Christ is the holy and true one.
Yeah.
And then because of the Christian life, then they also have an opportunity. They have an open door.
Yeah.
And then what is their crown then? Remember what is it?
Their reward.
Yeah, it's their reward for doing what? For holding true. Yeah, there's a good way to put it. For keeping on, shall we say, keeping on, keeping on. Mark Conrad's going to be coming up here for our conference, and that's one of the things Mark has challenged pastors and believers with a lot when I've been around him in different things. He says, you just keep on keeping on. Christians need to be encouraged to keep at the things that God set before us. It's real easy for us to become lackadaisical and get really distracted with all the different things out there in the world. And so we have an incorruptible crown that Paul talks about. Anybody else? Any other questions or comments?
The crown of temptation, related to temptation, you know, that was in James.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you were explaining, I didn't understand. Is that the idea that every time we resist a temptation, or is just the, as you're saying, these are all crowns that a believer could attain. Right?
Yeah, and you know that out of all of the crowns in here, that's the one that always kind of catches me like that. And so I'm just going to have to say I don't know how to answer that. Because if you have to resist every temptation that's come your way to get that crown, then no one's getting one.
Yeah.
If it's a matter of, well, you resisted the latest one before the rapture, before you die, well, that's kind of a toss-up, you know, about where you were at a given time, and so you don't know how that's going to be.
Maybe grades on a curve.
Or the other possibility is it could be, and I think this might be in the context of James, that it's a temptation that involves, because this could be true of any temptation that you get involved in, that it's a temptation that how you're going to respond is going to reflect your love for the saints. And so that really could become rather broad, but I think in the context, because he talks about it's a crown of life given to those who are loving him, it's the opportunity for you to live out that life and to do so in love for your fellow saints. And perhaps there is a unique situation for each and every one of us, and that's one of the possibilities, although I'm throwing that out really, and I have to admit, almost as pure conjecture, to say that perhaps every one of us are going to have some situation in our life that God's going to allow us to be in which we can face a specific temptation, and that temptation is going to reflect our love for the saints. In other words, I just, like I said, I'm just kind of throw out some things for you to think, but I have to be honest, that's a hard one to answer, and I've asked myself that question a lot. I mean, what are you going to do? Most of you are probably going to have several thousand temptations by the end of your Christian life. You know, if you deal with half of them, then, you know, are you going to end up with, you know, 5,000 crowns stuck on your head? That's a tough one to answer.
Best to resist all temptation if possible.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, though.
It's a good question. It's one I've asked a lot of times, and you can see where I'm at. But I'm thinking out loud on some of the things that go through my mind when I consider that. So, and I bounce this off of some other friends and such. So, anybody else? We'll practice. We're practicing 1 Corinthians 9 right now, bringing our under control for the benefit of the saints. Yeah. Well, let's close with a word of prayer then. Our Father, we are thankful for the evening. We are thankful for the provisions that you have made for us, the privilege of being in the body of Christ, being graced at your right hand, and then the privilege of even having that become the motivation for how we live our Christian lives. And we're thankful, Lord, for the privilege of being able to represent you here on this earth as you've presented placed before us open doors, opportunities, and help us then as believers to live our Christian life in such a way that that we take advantage of those open doors, that we use that open door to accomplish the things that you have for us. And we thank you for that. And we thank you for those believers that you brought out tonight and our brothers and sisters that had to be away this evening. We know that you are with them and that they are in your care. We ask that you might encourage them wherever they might be. And we thank you for that then. Amen.